Well, good afternoon. And I'm wondering if you can believe that the season's over. When I began to write my introduction of Senator Mitchell today, I realized that his contribution to our country is so enormous, so outstanding, that extrapolating from a 10-page bio is a true challenge, especially with a 2-minute rule for introductions. So I'm asking for an easement, okay? Senator Mitchell's years in the Senate, 14 of them representing his home state of Maine, included his position as Senate Majority Leader from 1989 to 1995. Now, my query is this. Why couldn't we somehow send you back to Washington to straighten out our fractured government? You are, of course, well known for your conflict resolution. Senator Mitchell's peace negotiations in Northern Ireland were rewarded with the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor our government can give, the Philadelphia Liberty Medal, the Truman Institute Peace Prize, the German Hesse Peace Prize, and the United Nations Peace Prize. And from Queen Elizabeth, he was invested as an honorary knight, Grand Cross of the Order of the British Empire. Now, it's perfectly clear that if anyone could make peace in Washington, the senator is our man. His efforts in the Middle East on behalf of two presidents, Clinton and Obama, surely honed his skills at conflict resolution and led to his chairmanship of the International Crisis Group, a nonprofit dedicated to the prevention of crises in international affairs. And then, just for some lighter moments, Senator Mitchell was chairman of the Walt Disney Company from 2004 to 2007. I don't know if you had any conflicts with Mickey Mouse. In 2008, Time magazine named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Back to the home front, he is a graduate of Bowdoin College, sharing that honor with another famous Mainer, General Joshua Chamberlain of the 20th Maine, the hero of the Battle of Gettysburg. Well, I think I've probably surpassed my easement here, so let me end by asking, how many of you in the audience are affectionately known as maniacs? Oh, a lot of you. Well, council members, please join the maniacs in welcoming Senator George Mitchell.
Thank you very much, Mimi, for that very generous introduction. Thank all of you, ladies and gentlemen, for being here today and for your warm reception. I speak often, so I'm introduced often. I've heard myself talk so much that, for me, the introduction is the highlight of the day. Mimi, I want to thank you, and I'm going to bring you around with me to various speeches that I give around the country. Now, of course, it's always pleasant to hear nice things said about you, particularly in public. The risk, of course, is that if you hear it often enough, you may begin to believe it. And that's dangerous for your mental health. So I like to begin with a story about introductions and how I was brought back down to earth. I chaired three separate sets of negotiations in Northern Ireland over a span of 5 years. After we got an agreement, I returned to my home in Maine, and I wrote a book about that experience. When it was published, I set out on a book promotion tour around the country. I received many invitations and was surprised to learn that in the United States, there are more Irish-American organizations than there are Irish Americans. All of them invited me to come. I couldn't go to all, but I went to many. And as I traveled the country, speaking at these Irish American events, there developed among the hosts an informal competition as to who could give the longest, sometimes ridiculous, sometimes fantastic introductions of me. The proper reaction, of course, would have been to show some humility, to encourage them to keep it short. I had an improper reaction. I loved it. I encouraged them. I spurred them on. I scolded anyone who left out an important fact. In Chicago, a fellow spent 35 minutes introducing me. He read a long list of everything I'd ever done in my life, many of which I had not been aware of until I heard him read them off. And when finished, I scolded him because he left out that I received the Science Award in my junior year in Waterville High School in Maine. But by the time I got to the last stop, it was the Stamford, Connecticut Irish American Club. I was overly impressed with myself. I had a hard time squeezing my head through the front door. But when I get in, the first person I encountered was an elderly woman who rushed up to me, very excited, nervous, almost bowled me over, shook my hand. She spent about 10 minutes telling me what a great man I am. And when she concluded, she said, I don't live anywhere near here. I drove all the way across Connecticut, 3.5 hours, just to shake your hand, to tell you how much I admire you, and to ask you, please, would you autograph my poster? And she handed me a poster with a photograph on it and a pen. I looked at it. I said, if you're happy to sign it, but before I do, I think there's something I should tell you. She said, what is it? I said, I'm not Henry Kissinger. She said, you're not. Well, who are you anyway? And when I told her, she said, why, that's just terrible. She said, I drove 3.5 hours to meet a great man named Kissinger, and all I've got is a nobody like you. I said, well, I'm sorry you feel so bad. I wish there's something I could do to make you feel better. She thought for a moment. She said, well, there is. And when I asked what it was, she leaned forward. I leaned forward. In a conspiratorial whisper, she said, nobody will ever know the difference. She said, would you mind signing Henry Kissinger's name to my poster? So I did. And it's hanging today on her living room wall in eastern Connecticut, a daily reminder to me not to take too seriously these kind words that Mimi and others have said about me. Well, I'll tell you one other story, and then I'll speak seriously for a few minutes and then take your questions. I entered the Senate under unusual circumstances. I was serving as a federal judge in my home state of Maine when one of Maine's senators, Ed Muskie, was appointed Secretary of State. The governor announced promptly that since it was in the middle of the year, in the middle of the legislative session, he would hold a press conference the following Monday at the state capitol to announce his choice to complete Senator Muskie's term. There was a lot of speculation in the press. We had a lot of former governor, a former senator, several former congressmen. My name was not among them because I'd just been appointed a federal judge the year before. On that Sunday evening, I went to bed early. As the Mainers here know, we go to bed early in Maine, especially on Sunday night, wondering what the governor would do the next day. And then about 11 o'clock at night, the phone rang. It was the governor calling. He said, I'm calling to ask if you'll come down to the state capitol at noon tomorrow so I can announce I want to appoint you to the U.S. Senate. I said, gee, governor, this is a real big surprise. This is an important decision. I need time. I got to call my family. I got to think about this. He said, I'll give you 1 hour. I protested. He said, that's it. So I said, okay, I'll call you back at midnight. I hung up the phone. I called up my three older brothers. I grew up in a small town in Maine, Waterville, Maine. There's some people here from Maine. They know where that is. My three older brothers were very famous athletes, well-known not just in our community or our state, but all over New England. I got them on the phone. In this small town where I grew up, there was a great emphasis on especially basketball. And my brothers were great basketball players. When I came along, I was not as good as my brothers. In fact, I was not as good as anybody else's brother. So at a very early age, I became known around our small town as Johnny Mitchell's kid brother, the one who isn't any good. As you might expect, I developed a massive inferiority complex and a highly competitive attitude toward my brothers. So when I called them that night after hearing from the governor, ostensibly to seek their advice, there was a note of triumphalism in my voice. I said, guys, the governor has just called. He wants to appoint me to the United States Senate. What do you think about that? Their reactions were predictably negative. My brother Johnny said, listen, he said, everybody knows you're a born loser. He said, we can't understand how you got to be a federal judge. You couldn't possibly win a statewide election, so you better stay where you are. My older brother, who fancies himself an intellectual, likes to use the Socratic method of dialogue by questions. So he said, well, let's ask first. Aren't the people of Maine entitled to have a qualified person representing them in the Senate? And second, he said, isn't it obvious to everyone that you are not among them? I hung up the phone. I called the governor. I said, Governor, I don't need an hour. I've already received all the reassurance I need. So I went down to the state capitol and day, noontime, the governor announced my appointment. I drove to Portland, flew to Washington that day. The swearing-in was scheduled the following morning, a Tuesday. But when I landed at National Airport in Washington, I really didn't have anything to do that night. So literally on a whim, when I got into the taxi, I said, take me up to the Senate side of the Capitol. And I went to the Senate. I went in, introduced myself to a clerk, a guard at the gate, and then a clerk. They took me in. The Senate was in session debating a bill. The clerk took me down to the well of the Senate where the then majority leader, Robert Byrd of West Virginia, was presiding over this debate, introduced myself to him. He was vaguely familiar with that I was coming. He said, oh, okay, we'll interrupt the debate and swear you in. I said, no, I'm not here to be sworn in. That's tomorrow. And of course, I'm thinking, on the way down, I'd wondered whether all three networks would cover it live. I knew, of course, that all of the newspapers in America would be there the following morning, so I didn't want to interrupt that. I said, excuse me, sir. I said, the swearing-in is tomorrow morning. He said, no. He said, Sonny, he said, listen to me. He said, when I say you're going to be sworn in now, you're going to be sworn in now. Okay, I said, yes, sir. That's it. So they interrupted the debate, swore me in. Took about 8 or 9 seconds. Nobody noticed. Senators standing 6 feet away were unaware of what had occurred. Profoundly disillusioning. And when the Senate immediately resumed session, the debate ended and a vote occurred. For those of you interested in political trivia, and you all are, otherwise you wouldn't be here today, nothing more trivial than hearing a former politician speak. I hold the all-time record in American history for having cast a vote the shortest time after entering the Senate. 2 minutes. The first of many informed judgments I made in your behalf. And in behalf of all other Americans. Well, after the vote, they resumed the debate. Now, I stood there. I was a senator. I had no idea where to go or what to do. I'd only been in Washington an hour. Pretty soon, a young guy comes in, rushes up to me, introduces himself as my administrative assistant. I'd never met him, never heard his name. He had been Senator Muskie's administrative assistant, and now he was mine. He proceeded to give me harsh criticism for permitting myself to be sworn in a day early, thereby disrupting the elaborate process that they had established. Then he read off a long list of things I was to do the rest of that day. And he concluded by saying, we have a terrific invitation. We just got a call in the office, just after you were sworn in, from the National Association of Certified Public Accountants. 3,000 of them are here in Washington. They're having a convention. And they called and asked, would you be the keynote speaker at their dinner tonight? And I said, I said, I know a lot of accountants. Every single one of them is really, really smart. But how could these guys possibly have known that I'm going to be here tonight and have held this thing open for me? Because I didn't know myself until just yesterday. He said, ah, it's nothing like that. He said, they've had 4 last-minute cancellations. They said they saw you being sworn in on TV, and they figured you may be the only member of Congress who has nothing to do tonight. I said, well, what do they want me to talk about? He said, the tax code. I said, you want me to go tell 3,000 certified public accountants, each of whom knows a lot more about the subject than I do? He looked at me and he said, straightened up with sarcasm and condescension, he said, listen, you're now a United States senator. He said, you will regularly be called upon to stand up in public and speak on subjects you know nothing about. He said, you better. Yes. Of course, that explains much of what you see on TV. Sometimes you wonder what they're thinking about. He said, you want to get started as a senator, you get down there tonight, you tell those accounts what's in the tax code. So I did. And here I am, come down here to a bunch of people who've been all over the world, many of you retired down here, know all. I'm going to tell you what's going on in the world. It'd be better off if you could tell me. But following the precedent I set in the Senate, here I am to say a few words about things in the world, and then I'll be glad to take your questions. Now, if you watch cable television, and who doesn't these days, it's conventional wisdom that the world is falling apart, that the world is more dangerous than it's ever been, and that the United States is in decline at home and retreat abroad. I disagree on all counts, and so I'd like to spend a few minutes telling you why. First, fear of the future and lament about the current state of affairs are as old as human civilization. Just about everyone here is old enough to remember the summer of 1968 here in the United States. The Vietnam War was raging. President Johnson withdrew. Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy were assassinated. Riots ripped through almost every major city in America. And we lived through what many regarded as an era of gloom and doom. There may be even a few people here, like myself, who were born and raised during the Great Depression, when unemployment in America reached 24%. And a frightened nation struggled to survive. Or, for lament about the past, you can go all the way back to 500 years before the birth of Christ. The word democracy is derived from 2 Greek words, demos, the people, kratzi, the rule of. The Greek city-states went through a long, slow-motion transition from dictatorship to oligarchy to democracy. It lasted several centuries. In the year 550 BC, these words were written, "Gone is faith. No one any longer reveres God. The generation of religious men is more." And then in words directly but equivalent to traditional values are being lost. They're remarkably similar, of course, to current words spoken about the loss of values. The trouble that so concerned the writer of those words, a member of a family of oligarchs, was that ordinary citizens were soon to receive the right to participate in their governance. The very first stirrings of democracy were regarded by those in power at the time as a loss of traditional values. Democracy was a radical departure from all that went before. Of course, the world was dangerous then. It's always been dangerous, and it still is. But by some important measures, including the numbers of people killed, the world is much safer than ever in the past. In the 20th century, in just the two major world wars, not counting Vietnam or Korea or all the many conflicts around the world in which the United States was not directly involved, just in two world wars, an estimated 78 million people were killed in a world in which the population was about a third of what it is today. Each death in conflict is a tragedy, of course. But today, the deaths are in the dozens, the scores, occasionally the hundreds. In the 20th century and before, they were in the many hundreds, the thousands, and on some tragic days, the tens of thousands. That could happen again if another world war breaks out. But that's not likely now or in the foreseeable future because of the overwhelming military dominance of the United States and of our allies. So while local and regional conflicts will continue and will have devastating impacts on those who are directly concerned, no world war is likely. In the coming decades, instead, it will become increasingly clear that the long period of relative stability that followed the Second World War has come to an end. During that period, many of the conflicts involved religious differences, as they do today. But then as now, there were and are complicating factors beyond religion. The naked drive for political power by ambitious men, mostly men, occasionally women, throughout all of human history, has frequently been disguised as a religious endeavor. So have the actions of many who, in normal circumstances, would be seen as purely criminal. They use accepted values like religion or patriotism to justify their violent and illegal acts. And in every conflict, everywhere, there is an underlying economic factor. I recall very clearly my first day in Northern Ireland. I was taken to the center of the city of Belfast, the largest and most productive. It's the political capital and the economic center of Northern Ireland. And right through the middle of the city, there is a large wall. It goes right across streets, right through buildings, and it physically separates the two communities. In the morning, I met on their side of the wall, ironically called the Peace Line, in some places 30 feet high, topped with barbed wire. I met with a group of what are called nationalists, predominantly Catholic, who want a united Ireland on the entire island of Ireland. In the afternoon, I met with a group that are called Unionists, mostly Protestant, who wish to remain part of union with England, Scotland, and Wales in what we know as the United Kingdom. Their differences were many. They had been in conflict for a very long time. But to my surprise, their presentations were virtually identical. They were best summarized by a Protestant minister, powerful orator, one of the most, we became friends later, one of the most impressive men I've ever met, who brought with him two maps. He tacked the first one up on the wall and spoke about it. It was unemployment in the urban areas of Northern Ireland. He then tacked another over it. It was titled Violence in the Urban Areas of Northern Ireland, and you won't be surprised to hear that they fit like a hand in a glove. He made the point that without opportunity, without jobs, without hope, without education, flooded with despair and frustration, there are the ingredients of violence, whether in Northern Ireland or anywhere else in the world, including the United States. And that remains true today. The United States economy, thankfully for us, remains by far the world's strongest. And I believe that we are, in fact, entering a period over the next few decades of sustained growth. I believe that as far into the future as human beings can see, the United States will be the dominant world power. Power is, of course, a relative term. So in order to measure it, we must measure the power of our likely competitors. Russia and President Putin are very much in the news these days. Half of that government's revenues come from directly taxes on oil and gas. The break-even point for the Russian national budget, the government budget, requires oil to be at $110 a barrel on the world market. There is not an expert anywhere in the world who believes oil will anytime soon be at that level for a long, sustained period. So Russia's economy is, in fact, contracting, and it faces a severe financial crisis mitigated somewhat by the decline in the value of the ruble. But according to recent news reports, Russia is now burning through its fiscal reserves at an alarming and unsustainable rate. In addition, Russia's population continues to decline overall. There were about 150 million Russians when the Soviet Union collapsed. In the next couple of decades, it will pass under 130 million, steadily declining. And most alarmingly for them, its composition is changing as the number of Slavs are in steep decline, while the number of Muslims, now about 12%, will increase soon to 20%. When he first took office, President Putin said that he was concerned that for the first time in 300 years, Russia faced the possibility of, in his words, slipping into the second or third echelon of nations. His concern was justified, although the possession of a large nuclear arsenal will stretch out that decline over the next several decades. Russia will continue to have an important voice in international affairs, particularly in areas geographically proximate to its borders, but neither Putin nor any other Russian leader will be able to reverse the inevitable decline. In contrast, China and India will grow in economic strength and influence, although they too face daunting problems. President Xi has acquired more power in his person than any Chinese leader since Mao Zedong. Xi plainly regards the continued, indeed the increased centralization of power within the Communist Party as essential to strong economic growth and what he sees as the needed transformation of the economy that is so essential to the authority of the regime. But despite its enormous capacity and potential, China faces major obstacles. Its rate of economic growth is, of course, slowing, as we read and hear about daily. The rule of law and an independent judicial system, so essential both to individual liberty and to business investment, have not been firmly established in China. Corruption is a major issue, one that the new leader has gone to extraordinary lengths to deal with, but that will take a cultural change over many decades. The demand for energy in China continues to rise, fueling more pollution and more protests, which are contributing to destabilization. The Chinese are an enormously energetic and talented people, but even with those strengths, they face a long uphill road to becoming the world's dominant power. India already is the world's largest democracy. It soon will become the world's largest country in population, while China between now and mid-century will grow from about a billion 300 million to about 1.4 billion, or perhaps a little less. India is engaging in explosive population growth, and by the year 2050, there will be 1.8 billion people in India. But it too faces truly staggering problems, and it is unlikely to become a dominant world power. Now, of course, in making an evaluation of this type, we must acknowledge that we in the United States also face very serious problems, and I'd like to address those just briefly before going to your questions. First, I think we must never lose sight of the reality that military power and world influence are grounded in economic strength. We must somehow find a way to get our political and our financial houses in order. All of us know it's an urgent need. Now, it would take a separate and long speech. I'll be glad to come back in a couple of years and give that speech. But we all know it's critical and it has to be done. Secondly, I think we have to keep reemphasizing and reminding ourselves that we have to stay true to our principles. It is democratic ideals that distinguished our nation from the very beginning. It is democratic ideals that have appealed to people all over the world. Our economic strength and our military power are necessary and important, but our ideals have been and are the primary basis of American influence in the world. They're not easily summarized, but surely they include the sovereignty of the people, the primacy of individual freedom, an independent judiciary, the rule of law applied equally to all citizens and crucially to the government itself, an opportunity for every member of our society. No one of us, no American, should ever forget that the United States of America was a great nation long before it was a great military or economic power. We recognize that all human beings and all human institutions are imperfect. We're not always right. We can never be perfectly consistent, hard as we try. And yet we can, and we must work harder to live up to our principles, both as individuals and as citizens of this country. And finally, I believe we must work hard, much harder than we have in recent years, to more fully realize the aspiration of opportunity for all of our citizens. America stands primarily for freedom and opportunity, a society in which no one should be guaranteed success, but every single one should have a fair chance to succeed. To achieve that outcome, it's essential that there be opportunity for every member of our society. We know from the experience of our daily lives, it's not now a reality, it's an aspiration. And our goal must be to make it a reality, which means that every child in our society should have the care, the early development, the education to enable them to rise as high and as far as their talent, their willingness to work, their willingness to take risks will carry them. In our country and all around the world, societies are struggling with several major trends. I'd like to mention just three briefly. The first is the interactive effects of globalization, dramatically expanded trade over the past half century, and rapid technological change. The second is the threat of global warming, and the third is population growth concentrated in the least developed and most vulnerable areas on Earth. Together, they create massive disruption, widespread uncertainty, and fear. Many factors affect population growth, foremost among them the status of women. Where women are independent and fully empowered, population growth rates inevitably stabilize. Increases occur only through surges of immigration. Where women are not independent and not fully empowered, population growth rates rise rapidly. And sadly today, in the most vulnerable areas in the world, in a large swath through Asia, across the Middle East, across Africa, and into Latin America, population pressure is greatly intensified by poor governance and widespread corruption, which often go hand in hand. Consider these facts. From the birth of Christ, it took 1,800 years for the world's population to reach 1 billion. 1,800 years for the first billion. The most recent billion, the seventh, was added in 13 years. Now, the growth rate is slowing, but the population is increasing. Of the 7.5 billion people in the world today, 1 in 5 is Muslim. That's about 1.5 billion. By mid-century, 30 or 40 years from now, there will be almost 10 billion people on the earth, and 1 in 3 will be Muslim. That's about 3.5 billion. To put that into perspective, that was the total population of the world as recently as 1970. Islam, as we know from the daily news, is now torn by internal conflicts, some of which overlap and intersect. Some are even contradictory. Some date from the colonial and post-World War I periods when the British and the French, then in their imperialist mode, imposed a political setting in the Middle East that disregarded the wishes or the desires or the interests of the people who lived there. Others of the conflict go all the way back to the 7th century and the competition to succeed the Prophet Muhammad. It was not a religious difference. It was a political competition between two factions for control of a political empire. The prevailing faction became the Sunnis. The losing faction became the Shia. And they have been in conflict ever since, marked by alternating periods of remission and then intensity and widespread conflict, and it is now very intense and expanding rapidly. Challenges to the established balances of power in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, and in other places have opened up that divide with catastrophic consequences for the people who live there. Radical Islamic extremists like ISIS want to impose a rigid form of Islam. They want it identical to the Islam which was practiced during the life of the Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century. Thus, the emphasis on crucifixions, on beheadings, on slavery. As we all know, those were widespread throughout the world then, not just within Islam. But they want to take their people and ultimately the world back 1,400 years. As the flood of immigrants from the region now demonstrates, to the contrary, what most people in the Muslim world want is what most people everywhere want: a stable and a secure society, a decent job, a home, and especially, crucially, a chance to get their children off to a good start in life. And tragically, as the current conflicts make clear, many of those immigrants will not find that life in their homelands or elsewhere. The Industrial Revolution took place for about 100 years, beginning about 250 years ago. It began in England, of course, and as machines replaced men, there was widespread fear that unemployment would rise to unacceptably high levels. There was, in fact, much misery and much exploitation. But overall, the increase in productivity was so dramatic that standards of living rose even among growing populations. Today, 250 years after the onset of the Industrial Revolution, we are struggling with the effects of a new revolution in technology and communications in the context of dramatic increases in global trade. I believe that future historians will judge the technological revolution that we are passing through as significant a turning point in human affairs as was the Industrial Revolution. Increases in productivity now have produced massive and unprecedented wealth, but increasingly in most society, the benefits are not felt throughout the whole society. And as a society, we, nor has anyone else, figured out how to replace the millions of middle-class, middle-income jobs that have been lost. Whether and how we solve this problem will dominate our lives and our politics for decades to come. The same can be said of climate change. One of the most disturbing features of our current political discourse is the extent to which the denial of scientific reality is so widespread that almost all of the many candidates for the highest office in our country deny global warming or oppose efforts to combat it or both in the face of so much scientific evidence is disturbing. The chairman of the Senate Environment Committee, one of the most important public positions in our country, said that man-made global warming is a hoax. In his words, the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. But he and those who share that view are wrong. The science to the contrary is clear and is becoming increasingly overwhelming. Global warming is a reality which must be acknowledged and dealt with by people everywhere on Earth. And as the dominant power in the world, it is important for the United States to play a role. I have confidence in our country. I have confidence in the people of our country. I believe that science and reason will ultimately, as it always has in the past, prevail over fear and ignorance. Keep in mind, there was a time when most people in the world believed that the Earth is flat. There was a time when most people in the world believed that the sun revolved around the Earth. I believe that we must and we can devise the policies to deal effectively with these and the many other challenges that will arise in the coming decades. We have to keep in mind that the solution to every human problem carries within it the seeds of a new problem, so there never is a final resting place for solving problems in human societies. How we come up with the right answers to these questions is likely to be as messy and as halting and as back and forth as is our political process. But in closing, I want to cite to you not just me who believes things are going to be better, but people who know something about it, like Warren Buffett, who in his recent annual report to the shareholders of his company, Berkshire Hathaway, wrote, among other things, "Many Americans now believe that their children will not live as well as they themselves do. That view is dead wrong. The babies being born in America today are the luckiest in history. American gross domestic product per capita is now about $56,000. That, in real terms, is a staggering six times the amount in 1930, which is the year that Buffett was born. U.S. citizens are not intrinsically more intelligent today, nor do they work harder than did Americans in 1930. Rather, they work far more efficiently and thereby produce far more. This all-powerful trend is certain to continue. America's economic magic remains alive and well." That's the end of the quotation. I, like Buffett, am confident that we will meet the challenges of our time, and as we have so often in the past, emerge a better and a stronger. And we are certainly going to be a bigger country. Among the population figures I did not cite was that among the developed countries in the world, the United States will be by far the fastest growing. By 2050, just 34 years from now, our population will go from the current 320 million to 440 million. Our goal should be a society which encourages striving and celebrates and honors success, which is conducive to innovation, and which enables us to benefit from the talent, the energy, and the skill of every single American. Genius knows no boundary, knows no language, knows no race, knows no ethnic group. It does need one thing: freedom. Steve Jobs' father was born in Syria. Jeff Bezos' adopted parents were born in Cuba. Would we be a better country if they had not been permitted to come here? Another question, a rhetorical question: does anybody believe that Steve Jobs would have created Apple had he been born and raised in Syria? Or that Jeff Bezos would have created Amazon had he been born and raised in Cuba? The open air of freedom that America offers, the opportunity to go as high and as far as talent and willingness to work will take you, is what's absolutely critical. I'll close with a personal note. I was reminded of this by one of the members of your audience. When I was a federal judge, one of the tasks I most enjoyed was when I presided over what are called naturalization ceremonies. They're citizenship ceremonies. A group of people who'd come from every part of the world, who'd gone through the required procedures, gathered before me in a federal courtroom in my home state of Maine. And there, I administered to them the oath of allegiance to the United States, and by the power vested in me under the Constitution and law, I made them Americans. One of them is here today. Dr. LaBelle, stand up. Where are you? Right here. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. It was always a very emotional moment for me because my mother was an immigrant. She immigrated to the United States from Lebanon as a teenager. She could not read or write. She spent 50 years working a night shift in textile mills. My father was the orphan son of immigrants from Ireland. He had no education. He left school after the third grade at the age of 10 and worked his entire life as a laborer, ending up as a janitor at Colby College in my hometown in Maine. But because of their efforts, and more importantly, because of the openness of American society, I, their son, was able to get an education and to become the majority leader of the United States Senate. After the ceremonies that Dr. LaBelle and others participated in, I spoke to many of the new Americans. I asked them where they came from, how and why they came. Their answers were always fascinating. They were common themes, and they were summarized well by a young Asian man. When I asked why he came, replied in very slow and halting English, "I came," he said, "because in America, everybody has a chance." Think about the fact that a young man who had been an American for 10 minutes, who could barely speak English, was able to sum up the meaning of America in a single sentence: everybody has a chance. Now, we know from our daily lives that's not the reality. That's an aspiration. We must work to make it a reality. And as we do so, every one of us should say every day of our lives, "Thank God that I have the privilege of being an American. Despite its many, many serious imperfections, still the most free, the most just, the most open society in all of human history." Thank you all very much. And I'll be glad now to take your questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Mitchell's book is available over at the side, The Negotiator, so just stop by on your way out if you'd like to purchase a copy. And now we'll open it to a few questions. Please go ahead.
Mimi? If nobody's got a question, I may read excerpts from my book.
You'll get questions.
I'll tell you a funny story about that. I've written 5 books, all nonfiction, no bestsellers. I became very friendly with a very superb writer, well-known. His name is Colm McCann. He's an Irish-American. He's written several books. And when I published this book, he came to the first event. It was a big crowd at New York University in Manhattan. And as we walked up the steps to the stage, Colm said to me, "What excerpt from your book are you going to read?" And I said, "Well, I've written 5 books. I've never read excerpts from a book." He said, "Oh, come on." He said, "Real authors read excerpts from their books." I said, "Well, I want to be a real author." He said, "Well, get a book and read some of it." So I did, and I kind of liked it. So sometime today I'll finish with a little excerpt from it. Make me feel better, whatever it makes you feel like. Make me feel better. So go ahead.
I almost hate to interrupt with a question. But let me tell you first how much I admire you and your service and the example you've set for all of us as Americans in your career. It's an amazing career, and we thank you for everything you've done over that career. I would ask a question about your work, your steadfast, undeterred efforts in Northern Ireland to achieve peace, or at least the cessation of the hostilities, and now is an ongoing, we hope, peace. Is there anything we've learned or you've learned from that we could apply to the Middle East and perhaps in some way arrive at some accord possible between the Israelis and the Palestinians? Further, just let me ask one other question about that Northern Ireland effort. My understanding is it was the women, the mothers in particular, that played a very important role in arriving at that stand down and arriving at that long-term peace.
Yeah. To answer the second part of it first, yes, women did play a significant role in achieving the outcome in Northern Ireland. It was a fortuitous convergence of many factors, including a significant increase in the role of women in the political process, specifically in the peace process, and generally in society. They became, mentally exhausted and frustrated by the overwhelming fear and uncertainty that existed when societies are engaged in conflict that is random and death occurs not just on confined battle lines between organized armies, but can strike anywhere at any time for virtually no reason other than where one happens to live or what one religion is. The situation in the Middle East, I did 2 tours of duty there, the first under President Clinton and President Bush, and then the second under President Obama, is unfortunately more complicated and difficult. There are many more external factors to the conflict that bear on it. There is, for example, no counterpart to Iran in the British Isles, and there is no internal conflict within overwhelming numbers of Muslims in the area of Britain as there in Ireland as there was and is in the Middle East. So I think it will take an extraordinary circumstance to achieve peace in the region. But I am optimistic because I have a fundamental belief, first, that there's no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. They're created, conducted, sustained by human beings. They can be ended by human beings. And secondly, I believe that societies, which are organized now primarily as nations, but also smaller subgroups, like individuals, ultimately act out of self-interest. And I think the challenge is to identify to the parties the self-interested benefits that will come from achieving a stable and decent society, even one in which differences remain, as they do in Northern Ireland, but in which differences are resolved through political processes, peaceful processes, as opposed to conflict. And I think ultimately that will be the case, specifically with the Palestinians and the Israelis. It's an immense subject, impossible to cover in just a brief answer, but I would urge those of you inclined to do so to, when you're out, when you're on your computer some night looking for interesting things, to take a look at a couple of things. A year before he left office, President George W. Bush traveled to Jerusalem, where he gave a speech to an assemblage of Palestinian and Israeli leaders. He was pushing what was called his peace plan, the roadmap for peace, and he made a very powerful speech basically saying to the Israelis, you have a very successful state, but you don't have security. Your people live in unbearable fear and anxiety, and as we see, it's even worse now, the recent horrific attacks on Israelis that are occurring on a daily basis. So you've got a good state. You want security. But the only way you're going to get security is if there is a Palestinian state living side by side in peace. As long as this issue remains, you're going to be subject to this anxiety and fear. To the Palestinians, he said, you don't have a state, you want one. We support your efforts to achieve one, but you're never going to get a state until the people of Israel have a reasonable and sustainable sense of security. So to both sides, he said, you should be vested in the other's success, because neither of you can attain what you want by denying to the other what it wants. And I think that captured it. You might also take a look at a document called the Clinton Parameters. President Clinton laid out sort of an outline of what he felt a peace agreement would look like just before he left office. It remains, although it obviously has been dated and isn't identical to what will occur, it remains a general view of approximately what is needed of the sides, and both sides pretty clearly recognize that. But it will take very strong leadership to do that, because both societies are deeply, deeply divided.
Thank you again, sir, for your service to our nation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.